Hey everybody, welcome to the 58th episode of the JDO Show. I am your host, J. David Osborne, and today on the program we have Jeremy Robert Johnson. He came by the apartment to talk about Skullcrack City and his new book, Entropy in Bloom, which dropped a little bit early. You can get that over at Amazon.com. We talk about a lot of strategies that he uses to promote his books while still remaining human, and the conversation veers in a lot of interesting and strange directions, as our conversations tend to do. You should definitely go pick up his books. They're fantastic. He's one of the best writers I know, and he's one of my best buds. All right, I'm going to keep this intro short and sweet. I'm going to get right into it. Have a good time with this. Have fun with it. Keep it close to your heart. Interact with it. Show it to people. Completely ignore it. Whatever you want to do with it. Really, it's up to you. It's a piece of content on the internet that you can do with as you please. But it would, you know what? It would actually be kind of rad if you shared it and told people about this, because I like having listeners. But yeah, anyway, that's enough of that. We're going to get right into it. I hope you enjoy this new episode of the JDO Show with Mr. Jeremy Robert Johnson. Thank you. Okay, so we're talking just now about how my brain is. Oh, hey, by the way, Jeremy, thank you for coming over. There's a very energetic dog. Can you go lay down? I love you. She's so excited that Jeremy is here. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
I'm here.
But yeah, we were just now talking about how I've spent a really, really long time trying to make like my books more accessible, and last night I had this epiphany where I was just like, oh, only like two things interest me about the project that I'm working on right now, so I just decided to do those two things really hard. And you were talking about with Skullcrack, you were thinking you had doubts about how it would do, but
basically I went into it thinking this is going to be my most divisive book, and it's going to really push a lot of people away, but the people who dig it are really going to dig it, because yeah. I'm just flying by the seat of my pants and doing whatever I want. You know, I had this more commercial setup originally that had less monsters and more of a private eye detective kind of aspect to it, and was going to be more hard boiled. And then the schleppier and dumber the character got, the more fun I had with it, because I was just like,
where it's like, let's make his dick weird.
Yeah, why not? I mean, I was like, my original premise, you know, when I finally decided I was going to do whatever I wanted with it, kind of changed it, was to take the dude from Big Lebowski mm-hmm. and put him in Chinatown mm-hmm. and then add monsters.
Yeah.
And have like a guiding female character like Maude, who clearly knows what's going on and is more sophisticated, mm-hmm. and have him just basically bumble his way through a whole story without accomplishing much.
Yeah.
And still somehow be the centerpiece of the story.
Right.
And so once I kind of got into that hook and went at it like it was a free-for-all, I had way more fun. And I thought to myself, well, at about a third of the way into this book, about half the people are going to set it down and never pick it up.
At what point?
That's when the brain-eating monsters show up. Because it was almost like rigged up like a trap. Like,
yeah.
Here you go. Here's your fucking, you know, central, you know, fussy white boy literary character who is just bitching about his life and commerce and saying all this counterculture shit, and then your little like techno thriller hook. So these things that are really inviting and comforting to people. And then I was like, oh, and then also there's brain-eating monsters and right. cosmic horror and galaxies and all this shit.
Right.
And I expected a lot of people to straight up just drop it right there. And I was pleasantly surprised that they didn't, but I was also kind of mad, because I was like, it felt to me like it should have been a more agitating situation to people
right,
when
right.
they encountered it.
Right.
And I was like, a lot later I realized I also wanted to satirize the hero's journey a little mm-hmm. bit and fuck with that. And it'd be like, you know, what if you put somebody who has no real heroic qualities through the rigors of the hero's journey, but try to satirize it and flip it a little bit at different points. But it turns out that kind of archetypal flow is much more powerful than my ability to try and be a punk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it didn't matter that I was messing with it. Inherently, it ended up pulling people through the book, because it was a weird comfort thing.
Right.
And then much later I realized it's just the Lego movie. Like, trying to satirize the hero's journey. Oh, I was like, because I'd been watching that a lot with my kid, and I was like, ah, oh, kind of made a slightly more adult version of the Lego Movie.
Oh yeah. Well, no, I mean, it's like, it's one of those things though where, like, even if you satirize it, you have to know it first, right? So it, and that's how it gets into like the bones of the thing.
Yeah, but you can't subvert it. It's so powerful. It's so ingrained in people's sense of story that trying to flip it on its back and you know, fuck it up, you almost can't, even if you do it purposefully.
Well, yeah, I think, well, I mean, you can't, I mean, I've seen some books where, you know, there's a lot of, like, word salad books now, which is just, like, to me, it feels like there's a lot of people who have the impulse to do something different, but nothing really to do with it, you know what I'm saying? So, I don't know, I see, there was, Evanson posted a thing to a magazine called Plinth.
Yeah.
Do you see that?
Yeah, yeah.
It's, like, a super rad, like, designed kind of thing. But, like, half the stories in that thing were just word salad. You know what I mean? Or, like...
They're anti-stories, dude.
They're anti-stories, yeah, exactly. Where it's, like, there's imagery and...
They're hot takes on modern story,
of course,
dude.
Of course, Evanson's story ruled, because he's just... He's one of the guys who can actually, I think, do an anti-story. Because did you read The Warren?
Yeah.
That's kind of, I mean, maybe a little bit. Like, there's development and things like that, but it's mostly a guy in a bunker.
Yeah,
and he's a clone of a clone of a clone, and he's just kind of lonely. And but it works.
His whole thing is even if his stories don't have a specific arc, they have that his syntax and the way he makes it get under your skin means it's almost more of like a psychological emotional experience, regardless of the narrative. Which for me, it's kind of fun when he decides there's a more clear set of characters and narrative through line, even though the reality itself is still highly subjective and fluctuating and fucked up. Like the in Collapse of Horses, the story about the dust.
Oh, I haven't read. You
know, so basically, these guys are all on this you know, in this mining colony, this outer space mining colony. Mm-hmm. And the dust is starting to accrete on everything, and the oxygen filters and the filters that are supposed to be pulling the dust out of the air are slowing down and stopping their work. And so the dust kind of encroaches on everything and drives them mad. And then bodies basically, okay, so it's like Session 9 in outer space. That's with tight. Evanson doing it. It's awesome. It's almost novella length, and it's like, but it was weird because it was almost a little bit of like, you could find the B.K. Evanson Dead Space stuff in there.
Cool.
Like, he was like, I want to take this fun, like, you know, outer space situation and that the dread that would come with being there and then, you know, creep it out.
Yeah.
Evanson style.
That reminds me of, I read The Wind from Nowhere because I'm going through Ballard chronologically. So that was his first one. And it's just, it's a wind. Like, there's just a huge storm that comes in, and there's this particular character who was, he was going to leave his, like, promiscuous wife, which I watched High Rise, so that seems to be maybe a Ballard theme of women just...
leaving.
But, yeah, there's just this wind that, like, cakes everything in this red dust. And it's just, like, it creates this entire sort of world where the forces of nature are very, like, input. Like, that kind of shit is really interesting to me. And then, because... I'm a fourth level chaos magician. We had a windstorm that knocked out our power for 3 days. So I feel like my brain connected to the ether and actually changed the weather and knocked out our power.
There's no way that's on you, dude. And if it is, like, you have to come to my house because it fucked up all my trees and took a stump out and stuff,
dude.
And you got to come clean that up.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sorry.
That wind was scary. That wind was gnarly.
When I woke up, man, I was like, well, because, you know, it's Oregon. There's fucking trees everywhere. And so you're just listening to this, what was it, 56 miles an hour?
Yeah.
Something like that. In some places, I think on the coast, it got up to 90.
Yeah, it was between 70 and 90 on the coast.
I was worried about Cam, man. Like, in
their basement floods there all the time, dude, in Astoria.
Like, it's just like...
a pump.
He moved to, like... just this kind of, it's like Innsmouth, but with lots of storms and stuff. It's like, it's kind of, it's a beautiful town. Astoria is like a beautiful town, but it also seems like dangerous.
It is dangerous, dude. there's like Astoria madness. It's one of those towns in Oregon where it's like, there's all the old fish people and everything smells like fish and there's these old like boat tribes and stuff, and everybody's on painkillers, and the doctors are like notorious. Like people drive in from other cities to get painkillers there and stuff. And whoa. So you have all these like slow moving old boat people on drugs, and then Cameron in at the brewery.
And they just and they live like right on the edge of disaster.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like
I mean, the tsunami is gonna hit them. The winds are insane. They're not at like a place where any of the beaches are particularly fun or accessible. They're more like scary. There's a giant, almost absurdly tall bridge. Like yeah. it's a.
It is an absurdly yeah. tall. Like, yeah. Why is that bridge so
for
tall?
For giant boats, because oh, okay. they have to be able to boats with huge masts, so they don't have to constantly lift it up and yeah, down since yeah. it's a port.
But it's pretty.
Yeah.
When
yeah,
it's
yeah.
when it's not trying to kill you, it's a very lovely town.
That's nature.
Yeah.
In general. Right. Like it's all cool looking, but it's all gonna kill you, and you shouldn't go closer to the parts that actively kill you, unless you're like Cam and you think it's the next artist community. Because you got tired of getting pink eye from crust punks in Portland, you know? So you're like, I'm going to move, dude.
It's so funny.
I'm going to Astoria.
He's a dad now.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Dad didn't change his folks.
He's such a dad. Dad mode. Messes yeah. everybody up.
How quickly did you... Was it immediate dad mode for you?
Dude, your, no. It was awful. It was like a death. It took me like 2 years.
Mm.
It took me 2 years. Around when I wrote to you guys and I was like... You guys, I gotta shut down Swallow Down Press, and I gotta. It was seriously a shift of identity. Like the kid was born, and he was like, "Oh, remember the old version of you and your wife? You yeah. guys have to die,
right?
And then be reborn into this new format of reality in which I'm a central piece and, mm-hmm. and must always be a central piece.
Mm-hmm.
Like at any moment, I know my phone could go off, right. and whatever I have planned, whatever I'm doing, instantly drops
right.
because of the kid. So I no longer exist solely for my interests,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
which is partially good and partially terrifying.
Well,
know?
It's like that's, I guess that's what happens to a lot of like dads who run away. Like, I think that probably scares the shit out of a ton of people, dads and moms too.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where
yeah.
it's like, I don't want to, cause I've known people, some people in my family actually who, you know, moms in particular who are like, you know, now in their 40s or 50s and they just never took responsibility
yeah.
for the kid. You know yeah. what I mean? And so I think it is like you do get to like a crossroad where you're like, I can keep being the same person, or like you said, like that Jeremy can die.
Yeah,
you
yeah. That I mean? That Jeremy was losing his mind trying to still be, you know, the person I was in my 20s and mm-hmm. and early 30s versus the person I had to become to stay married and be, mm-hmm. keep being a dad. Mm-hmm. Like mm-hmm. it was an important change.
Yeah, and I think Cameron, that change happened with him really fast too.
Yeah. Know?
Which is cool. It's cool that I actually have friends who are like responsible.
Well, I think Kirsten, you know, I think she had a post-it note on the fridge that said list of ways in which Cameron will become a man, and that he had to go through and check one off a month until he became a grown-up. So she's a very smart woman. She really is a driving force behind anything useful he's ever accomplished.
Right.
You
right.
know? Because I knew him before that, and he like was just the kind of person that would just run around a room screaming, throwing fish parts. And then have sex with an antique vacuum.
Right.
Like,
right,
he,
right.
I don't know. He was, he yeah, didn't make any sense.
No. Yeah. He still doesn't make a whole lot of sense, but.
People were knocking his teeth out all the time. Now he's yeah. like trying to get his teeth back. Like,
yeah.
he was, talk about chaos magic, dude. That guy yeah. is casting the runes and whatever dude. Other magic terms.
I love, dude, I love listening to that stuff, man. It's so funny because it's, for me, like reading books about, there's some people who do that shit who are incredibly smart and they have like really intelligent things to say. And then in the same breath, they'll be like, and so, you know, telepathy, which, you know, science has completely proven to be true. And you're like, wait, hold on. But, you know, cause like I say this a lot, but I read this really great book called Chaos Protocols, right? And it's actually a really, the first.
Is that Robert Ludlum?
No. It's
my favorite Ludlum.
No, yeah. So it's basically the first half is this actually really interesting analysis of like the way the economy, and he talks about how you need to enhance your probabilistic your probabilities for working in this economy, like making money and shit like that. And so I'm like reading that, and then yeah, like literally you hit like a certain point in the book, and he's like, so here's how you summon Satan to make that happen. You know what I mean?
Oh, dude.
And you're just like, yeah. How? It's so interesting because. That both of those things exist in people, you know what I mean? And so it's really compelling to me, like the kind of dynamic between this very groundedness and then the fact that they're like, So let's talk about, like, you know, UFOs.
Just totally and, esoteric
and,
shit.
And NDEs and, you know.
Well, and I was wondering, like, how much of it is just, you know, like a generation that grew up reading the Subgenius books and kind of accepting, like that faux metaphysical, any conspiracy theory, every theory works. It's all this, massive thing. And then other times I get the same feeling where I'm like, this, I know this is an incredibly intelligent person, and yet some of these ideas they're espousing are like stuff my friend Matt used to say, you know, when he was listening to Tool and taking, you know, eating mushrooms all night.
Yeah.
And exactly. I was like, you know, this is insane. You didn't make that toothpick move with your mind, dude.
Right, exactly. And
it didn't even move.
One of the things I like the most about it is because it's more interesting to me actually than fiction. Because a lot of fiction is super, super grounded in, like, materialism now. It feels like a lot of shit is focused specifically on the body. In fact, Rios takes writing classes, which are fantastic. But, you know, it's the Lydia Yuknovich.
The corporeal writing?
I mean, it's literally, like, about writing about the body. Which is cool. It's just, I'm going to actually probably take one of those classes soon because it just seems rad.
Yeah.
And I want to be a part of a...
Seems intense, dude.
I know, yeah. Right? It feels like Rios is like, yeah, you go there. You fucking cry, and I'm like, I'm into it.
Yeah,
I'll go. But yeah, no, there's a lot of stuff that's like focused on the body, but like, it feels like, as far as fiction goes, outside of like small press, there's not a whole lot that really, there's not like Robert Anton Wilson shit going on. So you kind of just, I go to those books for that.
Yeah,
where it's like, let's just take it all, throw it in a big pot, and then
it's a vibe, dude. I mean, the it's something I always loved about, like, when I was a kid, I would. My dad had a big box of all the Castaneda books. Mm. And so I just kind of, you know, fell in love with the mysticism of it, you know, and then would go out into the desert and try that stuff, try to do, like, mm-hmm. you know, the Gate of Power where you run. Yeah. But it turns out the reason that works is you're just doing incredibly high steps with your knees. Like, you stick your arms out for balance.
Okay.
You run with your knees up super high. Uh-huh. And it's like, yeah, you're not going to trip that way because your feet are barely ever on the ground. But your legs get super sore if you're not on hallucinogens. And, like, so then you also need the hallucinogens for the body aches.
Right.
So you can keep doing the Gate of Power through the darkness in the desert.
What's that supposed to accomplish?
It's like a way to not trip in the desert, basically. They call it the Gate of Power. And it's like a way to move around without falling over. Like, on your way from, you know, you telepathically talk to a melting dog, and then you run over and there's a tree that's your family, and then you run over and you jump off a rock and you land in a car, and I don't know, like Castaneda shit. Like, shit he made up in between killing women in the desert.
Right.
By the way, that's alleged.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's this thing going around the internet saying that he may be linked to, like, a series of murders where, when women became inconvenient to him somehow, he just dumped them somewhere in the desert.
Whoa.
Yeah. Well, I mean, because, you know, they say a lot of his stuff was a lie. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, to write a series of books about things that never happened and sell it as truth, it takes a fairly sociopathic personality.
Oh,
so,
totally. Yeah.
So you can kind of merge that with the idea that might be true. But again, it's alleged.
Right.
I don't want to get sued by his estate, or I don't know who would even be vouching for that guy at this point.
Dude, it actually, like, I was listening to some folks talk about suing in general, and I had no idea how terrifying that was, because if you get sued, you're going to, like, pay money.
Just to get out of it, yeah.
Just to get out of it.
Just to make it go away, dude.
Well, they were talking about how, you know, when people say, like, they settled out of court or whatever, and they're, so, you know, that means they're guilty, and they're like, no, it doesn't.
No.
It means that you don't want to, you'd rather pay them $25,000 rather than $200,000.
Right. And have it in the press all the time. Yeah. And, you know.
Exactly. It's just like, let's just make that go. That's terrible.
It's like telling a lawsuit to fuck off, settling out of court. It doesn't, it's not necessarily admitting to guilt.
It's just, there would have to be a system for people to get monetary compensation if bullshit happens, but that's crazy. You can just do that. Like, I'm just going to sue this person.
Well, it's a little more complex than that, but yeah.
Is it really?
I think you need a lawyer to sue them and stuff. You can't just, like, pull, like, a Michael Scott, walk into the room, I declare bankruptcy, you know, like, I am suing you, you know. I think you have to do some paperwork and shit, but overall, yeah, I don't know, I've never had to sue anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I got that. I looked into it when I got plagiarized in France to see if there was worthwhile.
Yeah,
you know,
tell that story. That's
and so
like, your whole, like, Extinction Journals, like, they were just translating it whole cloth and putting it
this guy did he did, I think, 5 or 6 different short stories out of Angel Dust Apocalypse across a 4 or 5 year period.
Whoa.
And he was converting them and selling them over there. And he got the short story, The League of Zeros, published in like 3 different venues. And what's one of those big fancy French colleges?
I have no idea.
Anyway, he got me published at like in a journal at a really fancy French college, and I was kind of like, I wish he would have just been my agent for that translation instead of stealing my name and developing a career. And he did it with 2 different names. And in League of Zeros, there's a character who modifies his body to have pieces of salad, you know, integrated throughout the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But since he was French, he changed it to pieces of cheese. He was Le Homme Fromage or whatever, like cheese man. He changed salad man to cheese man. I was just like, that's so fucking French.
That's great.
Like, you know, and he was selling this stuff. And then what happened is I actually got that story translated for a French speculative fiction magazine called Borderlands or something like that. Mm. And the guy saw that was coming on the message boards. It's a very, the speculative fiction community in France is apparently very small from the people I've talked to there. And so realizing that that would come out with my name attached to it, and he already had a couple versions of it out on the market.
Whoops.
He decided he was going to try and get ahead of it, and he contacted me saying, hey, you know, I have to let you know I've been stealing your career in France for 5 years. And I'm, you know, and but he was like kind of a crocodile tears thing, because he was like, I'm feeling suicidal about it. I teach English as a professor here at university, and this could ruin my career if it came out, and, you know, all this different stuff to try and gain my sympathy or whatever. And only in retrospect did I realize it was because he saw this thing was going to come out. That was, I found that out after the fact.
Wave was coming, yeah.
Yeah. And so,
what was your, like, your initial reaction obviously is like, fuck this motherfucker.
I was really angry at first. And then, so I told him, I said, you know, I'm going to have to talk to counsel about this, because my friend Kane is a lawyer now. He passed the bar, and I was like, well, he'll have some good advice for me. To see if there was any way I could get around it. But since, one, he barely made any money, like I actually checked with the venues, you know, there wasn't a lot of money to be made in selling short stories to the tiny French speculative fiction market.
Mm-hmm.
And, secondarily, there were issues with international copyright law that actually would have made it more difficult for me to pursue the work over there.
Right.
He offered to send me like $1,000, and I said, you know, what I find more compelling is actually if you would just let me interview you and find out why the fuck you did this. Whoa. Because that's crazy to me. Like, I can imagine like doing it one time to get some attention or something, like just to have that feeling of something getting accepted, because you're so hungry when you're starting out, you know?
Uh-huh.
But I couldn't imagine what would make you do it for 5 years straight with the same guy's work. You know, he was like up for awards and stuff. It was weird. And he was accepting all of it. And so actually I have interviewed the guy, and I'm trying to figure out a way to publish the interview without, because the internet is so ready to cast stones, right? So I'm like, how do I publish this without them looking him up and getting fucking internet shamed by people, you know, doing it on behalf of morality or whatever, when I'm fucking over it.
Yeah,
you know, he sent me contributors copies of all the books. I have all my French publications now, and it's kind of cool looking on the shelf. Fuck it, whatever. So I got this really cool interview with him, where he talks about really doing it. He said in the moment of translation, it was more typing it up and converting it. And then the moment he would go to sell it out, he said he got like a massive rush out of it. As if, you know, basically the adrenaline rush of committing a crime. Whoa. And he said it wasn't, and he said the moment he would get the acceptances and see it in print, he would hate himself. He became self-loathing at that point.
It's like coming, and then once...
Yeah, and then that immediate sense of just...
Balls, dude,
there's no point to me being alive,
Sidebar, even like when I'm not masturbating, when it's just like straight up, even sex, there's still that moment right after you're just like...
Why am I here? I'm the worst. Yeah.
I'm so gross.
The little death, dude. Why am I a fucking animal? It's disgusting, dude.
Exactly. But so anyway, so you get that thrill out of it.
Yeah, and then... so he was doing it for kicks. And he was doing it for a long time for kicks, until he found out he was going to get caught. And then he tried to cover his ass, and I got a good interview out of it. So I'm trying to figure out a way to get that out there.
You should have taken $1,000, man.
Yeah, maybe in retrospect. I've never been smart about finances and writing.
Me neither. No, but like international copyright law is really strange, because Rios watches these Korean variety shows. And you'll turn it on, and it'll be whatever is like the top 40 song here in the United States. And then there will be like the Indiana Jones theme song and Pirates of the Caribbean. And you're like, they have to be paying out the ass in royalties. Nope.
No. They're just using it.
They just use it because what are you going to do?
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I mean, you go over. There's a.
It's difficult to enforce.
There's a whole like Disneyland in the Philippines or something like that.
Yeah.
Which is literally, it's just, they just took Disneyland's plan and made it.
Yeah.
And they're like, meh, the fuck are you going to do? You're gonna come over to career.
Is it worth your time? Is it worth your time and effort? You know,
exactly. Yeah, which was interesting because you know they're fucking with Disney and Disney is notoriously litigious. But that's how fucked you are. If somebody did that in Korea, they could probably just email you and be like, "Yeah, I'm absolutely stealing your work."
Yeah, just so you know.
I mean, what are you?
Yeah, come and get me, buddy.
Are you sad?
Yeah. But I mean, the real recourse is that kind of, like, the psychological tender of being able to internet shame the guy. Because, mm-hmm. you know, with cases of plagiarism, it's so virulent when you see it, you know, when people report it. And the feeling people get is, you know, the level of internet butthurt people get over acts of plagiarism is pretty significant. So,
Yeah, no.
People get riled up over other people's problems real fast in the writing community.
That is true. That is true. That's why I think I'm just gonna hide for a while. Man, I've been so happy since I got self. Do you have self control or freedom? Which one?
I got freedom, and I love it, dude.
I use freedom on my phone, but I, for whatever reason, I had self control. I like it's a cool little. It's like a skull, so I feel like
blocks it good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But since that happened, it's just so freeing because it's like. I don't care. In fact, speaking of suing, the most interesting thing to me recently has been the United guy getting
his
ass whipped because that whole thing like started making me think about just how bizarre airports are.
Yeah.
Actually, like we give up a lot of rights just by stepping into an airport.
Dude, you get to hop on a machine, a giant metal machine that flies you to wherever you want to go incredibly fast. Like, you're trading those freedoms for, like, magic.
That's true.
Like, airplanes are insane.
That's true.
It's insane that you get to do that and get on there and shoot all over the planet.
It's pretty cool.
It's really awesome.
Yeah.
But,
and also kind of scary.
Yeah.
I get a little scared every time.
I get way less scared only because it's one of those things where you apply the statistical logic and you're like, okay, the shower I took this morning was more dangerous. The drive I took to the airport.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Way more people die in a shower than an airplane crashes.
I didn't even know people died in the shower.
People slip and get head trauma and shit. And
holy shit.
Old people in particular because of the difficulty of getting back up. You know, so they have those specialized. Have you seen all that shit? They got serious rigs.
Oh, no, I've
like,
seen them, yeah.
You know, where you open it and you only have to step over a 2-inch lip to get in and then it seals watertight. And I was like, that actually looks pretty cool. Like, I kind of dig that. It's got chairs and shit in it.
Yeah, just like sitting in the shower.
It's like one of those old people things I'm looking forward to. You know, like there's a lot of it.
Right.
Like just falling asleep in the middle of conversations.
Dude, that would be super rad.
Like when the like old guy drift off, where they're like, oh, he's snoring.
Yeah. I look forward to being able to, instead of feeling compelled to spit whatever thought comes into my mouth, being able to do the old guy, like, where you're, like, looking for it, and everybody's just like, just give him a second. Because, you know, it's not necessary. But,
no.
But anyway, yeah, no, but that was crazy. I didn't realize that they could just beat you up if they wanted your seat on an airplane.
I think, ideally, from everything I've heard, they're not supposed to. They're supposed to block you before you get in. They're supposed to kind of do a more accurate head count. And it sounds like they fucked that up. But to me, the mystifying part was just, like, have that one staff member not make it to the next airport. Like, you know, and somebody gets their soda pop and microwave meal, like, a little slower on the next plane.
Right.
And you don't have to deal with that shit. You know?
Yeah, but that was crazy. Yeah, but they're like, no, call the police.
Yeah,
and get like yank this guy off of a. Yeah, it's one of
he got selected by computer lottery supposedly, which was the other like that's a new element I've been reading about that's interesting to me. Just that supposedly it was like you know press your luck like they activate it and it's spinning around a list.
Then the whammy comes in with like the like.
They're like, you duck, you're out of here.
The superhero cape. It's like meh.
You're out of the plane. I was like, is that true, or did they just, is that something they say, and then they're like, get
they
that guy out of here.
They say it, because he was an older guy, and it seemed like he would be...
Might probably, yield easier.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's like, it's weird that the computer lottery never, like, lands on the MMA fighter, you know?
Yeah.
Sitting just back there where they're like, hey, you know, Mr. Roadkill, like, you have to leave the airplane.
They want somebody draggable.
Right.
Yeah.
Which
is what I have on my Tinder profile.
Super draggable.
just looking for someone draggable. It's my whole thing. Like, it's not, it's just so intimate, like, to drag somebody around.
Fireman carry.
Yep.
Is it? Yeah. No, it's great.
Carries and drags.
All right, cool. And we're back. We just took a pee break, which is what humans do when they have to pee.
The dog scared me.
Oh, did you
get
scared?
Ghost. Yeah.
Yeah. There's like, yeah, no, that's always the thing about animals is that they can see all the different ghosts that live in the apartment.
They can smell them.
They can smell them.
Ghost odors.
Yeah.
This is also the name of my memoir coming up.
Ghost
odors.
Ghost odors. But no, yeah, actually, I want to talk a little bit more about...
Twitter?
No, you're
right. Hot takes?
No, you're...
Well, Baby's Day Out?
I do like Baby's Day Out.
That movie's fucking garbage, dude. It's so transparently, like, what do people like? Bumbling thieves getting hit with mallets.
Yeah.
How can I give him more of that now that Culkin won't work with me and he's not cute? I'll put a baby in it and I'll get Panagliano and Mantegna to chase the baby around.
Oh,
that movie's fucking garbage.
But remember the part where Mantegna falls on that pipe and he hits himself in the nuts really hard?
Dude.
That part was
which time?
No,
that's like half the movie.
There's a part where he falls on a pipe outside of a building and he just lands, he just, you know, he horses it, basically.
No, that's Panagliano lands on it. He's falling, and you think, oh no, he's going to fall to his death. And then he lands on it, and it hits him right in the crotch in the face, and he stops dead. And then he blows out a little puff of dust. I watched it last night with the kid.
Why were you watching?
My wife refuses to watch animated films with the kid. She's just super over animated. We went through all the Disney, Pixar, you know, whatever. And so she's trying to find live action movies that are appropriate that she can watch with him. And she got on John Hughes' kick. And showed him Uncle Buck and Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh, those are good.
And yeah, they're all right. They're not necessarily 6-year-old appropriate, we found out. Like, the next week he got caught swearing at school and stuff. And I was like, where'd you get that?
Oh,
and he was like, Uncle Buck. And then he was like, but also I said this. And then he dropped an F-bomb on me. I'm like, where'd you get that? And he goes, Aesop Rock. And I was like, oh, okay, that one's on me. That one's totally on me. Because I feel like Aesop's innocuous enough for kids. Like, his messages are ultimately either positive or kind of weird, depressing. Like, but it's not... Like, I'm letting him listen to, you know,
like
3-6 Mafia.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, he wouldn't understand Migos. Nobody does, dude.
That's
half the time.
Yeah, no, that's
What's a bad and bougie? But, so I got caught out for that one. I'm trying to make him, a swear and kind of crime and innuendo-free hip-hop mix. But it turns out even, like, Tribe Called Quest and Talib and, like, these, you know, conscious rappers you think would be the go-to don't necessarily...
Now, does that come from just, like, not wanting him to repeat that in public?
I just don't want him to get in trouble at school.
Socially acceptable.
Yeah.
So you don't have anything, like, against it necessarily.
No. I told him I was, like, they're considered vulgar terms, you know?
Yeah.
And I was, like, and then I told him the whole thing about, like, you know, ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Bad ideas are offensive. Bad words are just words, you know, that kind of shtick or whatever. But at the same time, like, I don't want him getting in trouble at school.
Yeah. It's one of those things where you have to kind of compromise and be like, hey, this is...
It's part of the rules there, and since he's a 6-year-old and he works a lot on impulse and like figuring out what people get responses, you know what he likes to provoke things to see what'll happen.
Yeah.
And so, I can try and give him those guidelines at home, but that doesn't mean he's going to exercise restraint when he's hanging out with his friends, Pokemon or whatever. He's just going to start swearing to see what happens.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and so it's more like I just kind of cut it off at the pass and then address it when it does pop up.
Yeah, because I mean, like that's just, you know, that's what kids do. You know? It's like, hey, you ever heard bitch?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, whoa.
See what the other kids do? I did that once. I was, my grandparents ran some apartment buildings over in Redmond, Oregon, and there was a little kid down at the pool, and I was like, check out this word I learned. And I spelled it out for him. I was like, it's fuck. F-U-C-K. So he turns around, literally, the moment I tell him this, he starts, marching with his hand up in the air going F-U-C-K, F-U, marches all the way back to his grandma's apartment, right? And I'm supposed to be hanging out with the kid. So I go and I hide in my grandparents' apartment. I hide under the bed because I know
like
a hellstorm is coming.
I
was like...
I have F-U-C-K'd up.
Yeah. So I ran and ultimately I think they realized I was under the bed and they thought to themselves that I was so ashamed and afraid that I'd already been punished, like because I'd kept myself under a bed to get away from it. And so they came into the the room, kind of, you could tell they realized I was under there, and then they walked right back out, and I just stayed under there for, like, another 5 minutes just to make sure it had blown over, and then...
That's what happened to me, man. When I was a kid, I was the same way. I was such a mama's boy that, like, I wasn't supposed to play Mortal Kombat 2.
Oh, dude.
But I went to my buddy's house, and I totally played Mortal Kombat 2. And I went home, and my mom was going to tuck me in, and I just remember I started weeping, and I was like, I played Mortal Kombat 2.
You had to tell her?
I had to, yeah. And then somewhere along the line, I lost that sense of shame.
Right.
I don't know when. It was probably just, like, teenager, you know, listening to Korn and stuff. Just
being like, and then you're like, this is mine now.
Life sucks, man, so who cares, man?
Dude, I honestly, I want to do a poll someday to figure out, though, because there's two things that I have an affinity for in the world that seem to be widely loathed are Korn, like the first five albums, I'd go as far as to say that, and then Pearl Jam, most of their catalog.
I don't like Pearl Jam.
No, most people don't, it appears. But and yet they sold a quadrillion albums, so obviously they have their fans. Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, music is like the most subjective form of art I've ever seen in my life. You know?
Yeah.
Like, what hits some people is insane to me, you know? But,
especially now.
I just wonder, like, I think it would be cooler at this point to dislike Pearl Jam somehow.
Maybe. I mean, well,
like, Korn maybe has gone so far into, like, they did a dubstep album. Like,
it's so ridiculous.
At this point, they're so beyond it that maybe it's like, you can pretend to like them and it's cool again.
I think so. I think they made they came back with memes, you know, from, you know. Kids are making Korn memes who, this is sad to say, like, they weren't alive when Korn's self-titled album came out, which is very strange to say. But no, they came because they're just so, they're like Monster Energy drink.
Yeah.
You know, their logo looks like, you know, it's like scratched out of, you know, whatever. And he literally just like makes animal noises on some of the songs. So it's hilarious.
It's like kind of what I loved about it when I first heard it.
It's fantastic, dude. And you know what, just to make... it's so interesting because I remember you and I, we used to talk about rap music a lot and we would differ on a lot of things. And this was like maybe like 10 years ago or so, right? Maybe five, I don't know, 5, 6, something like that. And I would always be like, man, like Jeremy doesn't like a whole lot of shit that like I'm talking about. And then something happened like a year ago where now I'm like, I don't like anything new.
Yeah.
It's like you get to, I don't know, maybe you just like get to a certain point and it's just like, this is the cut. This is, I had to draw the line at Lil Uzi Vert.
Yeah, Lil Uzi Vert. Dude, I tried so hard. I did a whole album. Well, I did like the first minute of
Lil Yachty. Like,
Yachty?
When those two, I'll
give him some room.
When Uzi Vert came out, I was like, this is it.
Yeah.
I've reached that point where I can no longer.
There's a new one that's actually called, I think, just Lil Ugly.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't tell if it's parody or not.
Yeah.
And it goes back to like, the first time I heard Juvenile's Haw, I thought it was actually like a huge step forward for society, though, because I thought the world had finally accepted its first mentally handicapped rapper. I say that not like I genuinely, with his, you know, his speech inflections and the way he was flowing and stuff, I was like, I think that young man has some developmental disabilities, you know? And then there's different times like when Soulja Boy popped up.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, Big Sean, or there's other times, a Lil Uzi Vert, where I'm just like, this is clearly hot garbage.
Yeah.
But I had an epiphany about it recently. I watched that Evolution of Hip Hop thing on Netflix.
Oh, I haven't seen that.
And they had an interview with the guys from Run DMC and Russell Simmons and stuff like that. And they were talking about how everybody wanted them to still do the like, and they were like, no, just, you know, a snare, a cymbal, and us just talking about our shoes, you know?
Right.
And Russell Simmons was like, yeah, fuck that old shit.
Right.
You know, we didn't want to be like them. We didn't want to be like them at all. And I was like, okay, that's the amazing driving force that constantly keeps hip hop changing.
Yeah, for sure.
And it's like, there's going to be these anomalies, these fucking like Nelly's little sing song shit, you know? Like, I liked Bone Thugs, but Nelly's sing-song was hideous. I would change the radio instantly if he came on. Like, there's all these different ebbs and flows, and there's different creatures that are going to survive. And I feel like, personally, the mumble rap scene is going to be a flash in the pan, you know?
I think so, too.
Just like Soulja Boy, you know? Like, or different, like, dance-driven things. But I get the fact that right now, that is the counterculture. It's the young kids saying, fuck those guys. We're going to do what we want. Like, you know, in interviews when they're like, I don't give a fuck about Biggie and I'm a rock star, you know?
Right.
And I don't give a fuck about hip-hop history. I'm just doing what I want. And I was like, okay, well, the ethos is still there then. You know, well, it's just I don't like listening to it right now because it's not my favorite iteration.
Yeah, no, that's totally true. Yeah, and I think that, like, the biggest thing that always got me was that I hated when people were like, I just like lyrical rap. You know what I mean? Because what that means is that you like rap where people say the word lyrically a lot. You know?
Yeah.
Lyrical, dense, lyrical, you know, like, and they would just...
It's so like, many rippity raps.
It's like how...
So many syllables to this, dude.
What's that song? What the hell is it? Is it a Tech N9ne song where, like, every white dude with dreads ever is like, have you heard this fucking Tech N9ne song? And it's about, like, it's like a story.
Yeah.
And it's about somebody, like, killing and raping this woman. And it turns out the woman is, like, his own mother, but he never knew his mom.
That sounds about right.
What the
yeah.
hell was the... It's some dorky... But they're, like, they'll be... done with the song and they'll be like, chills, bro. Chills. And it's like...
I'm a sucker for story raps, but that sounds kind of awful, dude.
No, it's like it's like the worst.
And I'm not anti-tech either. Like,
No. I don't think it was Tech N9ne. I can't remember. It was one of those like borderline juggalo.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like where they walk between the worlds.
Yeah.
But basically, that always bothered me because there was good rap, I think, at a certain point where it wasn't as lyrical, quote unquote, but it was still fun.
Yeah.
And interesting. But, you know, kind of the logical progression of that, if that's what was happening 3 or 4 years ago, it increasingly, until it's like, how little can you actually say?
Right.
And then you get to a point where it's just like, you're just like making sounds. And some of it's really, I like the new Migos.
If their sounds, look at like Beastie Boys' Ill Communication.
Yeah.
They fuzzed out their vocals through that whole thing. Like half of the time, their vocals are acting almost entirely as like another rhythmic element. Mm-hmm. Like, you know?
Yeah.
So... shit like that's cool. It's just do you feel it or not? I was what happened to you know what I got converted to recently?
Mm.
I had a face surgery. I had an abscess in my skull they cleaned out and they gave me a bunch of hydrocodone afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had that and I was using it cuz I had a hole in my face.
Right.
I was in pain and I started listening to a lot of Future.
Dude, I love it.
And it snapped for the first time. For the first time ever I was like, fucking Future, all right,
the
vibe hit me.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And I was like, okay, this had to be introduced to me in a very specific time and place. Like, the first time...
Was it Dirty Sprite 2?
Yeah, DS2.
Yeah,
DS2 killed me. It was a great album.
Best. Yeah. It still was best. Yeah.
And the first time you were posting clips of him, I thought it was just more comedy videos from the Let Me Smang It guy. I thought that it was the same dude. And I was like, oh, he's getting really into this, like, comedy rapper or whatever.
Seems
kind of goofy to me. And then it was like 5 years later and everybody's still talking about him. I'm like, all right, I'll check it out.
Right.
But sometimes that stuff just has to find you. Like when I was a kid, I only wanted to hear gangster rap for mm-hmm. a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so Tribe Called Quest Low End Theory,
mm-hmm.
I bought that, owned it for 5 years until one day I put it on. I was like, oh shit, this is an amazing album too.
Right,
but
right.
I was mad they didn't swear enough and nobody got shot. I was
this is
bullshit hip hop.
Exactly.
These happy-go-lucky fucking idiots.
Right.
You know, and then I listened to it 4 years later. I was like, okay, this is
like
pretty righteous.
With hyphy shit, because I was always like, E-40 and like Too Short, I'd be like, this is goofy as hell. But now, if E-40 comes on, I'm like,
stoked.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
It's great. And Too Short also. But yeah, no, it just takes a while, because I didn't... Yeah, I was in the same boat, man, where I didn't like happy music.
Yeah.
You know? Like, I felt like if it was happy, it was somehow less smart.
Well, from like 15 to 25, everything has to confirm for you, like, that you're very important and that the world is awful. That's the two feelings you need to get from, like, all art. Yeah.
Right. No, absolutely. Yeah, I guess that's reflected in, like, the books, too. But, you know, good stuff came out of it. Read Infinite Jest. That one was pretty good. I like that book.
that's a jam, dude.
It's a good one.
Underrated, though.
Yeah.
you guys should check it out.
It kind of like the tide turned against Infinite Jest in a really, at least my impression.
There's a strong backlash.
Everything is like filtered through the bubble of what I see on social media anyway.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't know if this is true or not, but, you know, it did get to a point where like Infinite Jest was like a punchline, which is fine. I mean, I'm not married to it.
But is it a punchline being delivered by people who've read it? Necessarily,
no,
or is it just
no,
like
I think it's one of
it represents something.
It represents something
like fish fandom, you know.
Yeah,
it's like an easy go-to for a certain cultural subset.
It represents
the tool,
you know.
Yeah,
exactly. It's like I read Infinite Jest, and you know, whatever.
Yeah,
dude, who cares?
I know about all the patterns in Lateralis, bro. There's you can't even listen to that album straight anymore because that's not the real version,
dude. It's you got to Fibonacci that shit out, man. It is a Fibonacci sequence, though, right? Like,
one of the progressions is supposed to be like based on that or whatever.
Wow.
The time signatures.
Wow, good.
I don't know, dude.
I always liked a perfect circle better.
Yeah. 13 steps, like awesome.
It's one of the best new metal album ever. Dude, remember when I put that what's the best new metal thing on Facebook, and every album that people really, really liked, they'd be like, that wasn't new metal. They'd be like, 13th Step wasn't new metal.
It would definitely fit into that era, dude.
Yes, it was.
Yeah.
Like, and it was new metal just kind of meant bad.
Yeah.
Not bad. System of a Down was good.
Dude, I still listen. I have every single Deftones album. I have like everything Moreno's been on.
But that was the other band where people were like, Deftones isn't new metal.
Everybody tried to pretend. Dude, those first two albums are so new metal.
Oh, yeah.
You go back, they had the Frosted Tips and fucking everything, dude.
Yep. It definitely was. So I have this theory that I wanted to talk about. I wanted to talk about like success with writing, because it seems like Skullcrack did really well.
Yeah,
it did. And continues to do
it
well.
It continues to surprise me, yeah.
And you haven't seen any numbers on like Entropy and Bloom?
Not yet. We got our first week's book scan in for the accidental Amazon drop. I didn't know that was a thing that happened.
That was interesting. Yeah, just kind of like
happened. And so, yeah. So I found out from the editor that stuff like Harry Potter has a firm drop date. Like, you know, you're going to get crushed by the distributor if they find out you released it before midnight on a certain date or whatever.
Right.
But almost everything else that's coming out of the presses, Amazon will turn it around the moment it receives it, regardless of the projected release date.
Oh, so that's, and not, so what happened, that's not just a small press thing, because that's happened to me several times too, where I've said like, hey, this will be out.
And then it's out.
And then it's just there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was Amazon got hard copies and they were like, well, we have these now, let's fulfill our orders. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And then Simon & Schuster tried to jump up to also release the Kindle edition on the 3rd. Mm-hmm. But there's these competing numbers on the Amazon system that won't let people actually receive the Kindle edition or digital editions until next Tuesday.
Got it. Okay. Yeah.
And so it got really weird. But the thing was, I'm pretty calculated about how I spend my time right before a book comes out and then after it comes out, mm-hmm. to try and get it in front of people. Because if I'm going to make art, you know, it's cool for people to see it, absolutely. Know it exists, and absolutely. Engage with it, you know?
Yep.
And so it was, I kind of got whiplash because I was out on spring break with the kid trying to finish up another book, trying mm-hmm. to, you know, get this thing done. And so my whole focus and energy, you know, I'm meditating on the themes and how I want this one book to work and trying to figure out this problem. And all of a sudden I look online and there's a bunch of pictures of Entropy and Bloom and I'm like, oh, it's out?
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So
right.
I guess I'm adjusting my plans kind of, you know, and I've kind of caught up from that, but...
So what is the plan then? Is it fielding press or...
It's trying to modulate it so that, to some degree... The different chances I have to put the book in front of different readers and remind people about the presence of the book don't all land on the same day. So basically it's like attempting to really space out, you know, stuff. And there's only so much you can do with, you know, third party media, like the Publisher's Weekly thing just came out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't, but it, you know, with the smaller stuff, it's a matter of like, when do I send out ARCs? When do I schedule podcasts? When do I schedule print mm-hmm. interviews, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And trying to, so that it's not just, you know, so I don't give people a really easy reason to unfollow me on all social media because
it's a tough balance. Dude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so my plan's basically like to try and remain human at a time when I'm supposed to be marketing.
Yeah.
Because marketing's so kind of inhuman, mm-hmm. you know, the way it's mostly done. So I was surprised, but I'm recovering and hopefully next week, you know, we get a lot of the other like mainstream stuff that the publicist was sending out for. We'll see.
Oh, cool! Yeah. So that's a recent development. Because,
that's super new to me.
Yeah,
dude.
Yeah. So
I've been my own publicist for 10 years.
I guess just like talk about like, I thought what you did with Skullcrack was really cool and really effective because it's got what, like 140 fucking Amazon reviews.
156,
which is big.
Yeah.
Like that's what it's the number of reviews that matters.
Yeah.
And I find that shit with me too, man. Like when I'm looking on Amazon and I see that it has 500 reviews and it's like 3.5 to 4 stars, I'm like, it's social proof.
It's innate. It's I watch this show called Brain Games with mm-hmm. my kid all the time, and they were talking about how, you know, sheer number of star reviews or, you know, societal confirmation of the quality of something is super comforting to the human brain.
Right.
And has been since the days of like, oh, he ate from that tree. Did he die? No. Is everybody stoked on eating from that tree? Let's go eat from that tree.
Right.
You know,
so
it's a super ingrained reptile brain thing that I do try to, you know, emphasize getting reviews and stuff in there.
Yeah.
And so also reviews can't post until next Tuesday. Even though the book is out, their system won't let the reviews post until next week.
Because that's when the actual date...
Yeah, they won't let reviews post prior to the release date unless it's part of the Amazon Vine Voice program.
Late capitalism, bro.
Yeah, dude.
It's a monster. It's not as bad as the... You know, it's never as bad as people say it is, but yeah. It's also never as good as people say it is. So it's like... Dude, there's layers, man. It's somewhere in the middle. But it is this giant... Like,
challenges. People are fickle. And by the time Amazon will let them post reviews, if they've already read the book and moved on emotionally, and they're not in that space where they're like, I enjoyed this, and I'm willing to take 5 minutes out of my day to tell other people they might enjoy it, that opportunity is fucking gone.
That sucks,
man. You know? Yeah. And so hopefully, you know, that comes back around, and fingers crossed it gets out there. Because if this book needs to do pretty well because of what I'm trying to do with the next book.
What do you mean?
So the next book I'm supposed to do is going through. I've got interest from like a couple different of the mainstream presses. It's a relatively high concept idea I had a long time ago that, you know, I pitched a bunch and this was the one they were interested in. Mm-hmm. And my agent's hoping to like take it to auction and won't even let me talk about the name or the concept or anything. Mm-hmm. You know, she's like, keep that to yourself until we are able to announce in Publisher's Marketplace where it landed.
Sure, sure.
Yeah. You know, which is a new thing for me, especially in the age of like social media when you're like, oh, I typed 3 letters today. Yeah. You want everybody to pat you on the back. So
exactly.
Like, you know, it's going to be a challenge because that's what I'm working on between now and September is like closing out that project. But part of the New York thing that everybody's told me is that once you have a book out on any kind of level of New York press, that ISBN is a big determining factor in the value of your next title.
Right.
And it's book scan numbers.
That's what's so scary about it.
And so I'm like, here I am. I'm sitting on what is supposed to be this, you know, introduction of me to the mainstream readership. You know, it's all these short stories in the new novella. And, hoping that that can do well enough, even though it's not entirely a brand new product, that that when New York goes to look at the next thing, they'll think of me as a quote viable commodity, which is a disgusting way to think of yourself.
Dude, like, you have to contain multitudes, right? And you have to have that kind of like business sense, right?
Yeah.
So what would it be like? 2,000, 3,000?
Yeah, I mean.
What constitutes a success with something?
I talked to this guy who's an executive editor at Crown and was talking to him about Skullcrack City and stuff because I've been getting different people putting out feelers and stuff saying, oh, what's next? You know? And, you know, I said, hey, I just, you know, part of me wishes I would have tried to go to, you know, with full trade distribution for this title just because of how well it did and wonders what it could have done.
Right.
And he was like, honestly, it sold better than most of our titles last year.
Wow.
And this is from one of the, probably the top two biggest publishers in the country,
yeah.
You know? And so the numbers I've heard they're looking for now is you need to be, you know, anywhere from like 2,000 to 5,000 sold on the hardcover front. And then maybe, you know, through 2 or 3 reprintings on the paperback to really look solid. But then I've got my agent, she has people that are selling 100,000 books for her.
Right.
You know,
right.
But in like markets where I don't exist, like, you know, urban fantasy and shit, you know, things like
those
that.
Those are just the genres where like those are the ones that really sell.
Romance is 50% of the market. Like, dude, some of this stuff is literary, but it's romance and it's the romance that ends up being a hot ticket, you know? And so I can't, obviously can't compare what I'm doing to that
YA,
kind of
post-apocalyptic
market.
Stuff. Like that's going to be another huge thing. So yeah. And I mean, like, that's something that I was thinking about with my own stuff too. I think I might have put something on Facebook about this, maybe. But, you know, it's realizing that, you know, you're doing a niche of a niche of a niche of a niche. But then what can you do with that? You know, like, how do you kind
then
of
it's
find
like,
those people?
Find the right readers.
Okay, because I have some theories about this. Did the Polonic blurb do a lot? Do you feel like that kind of took, I mean.
It was a tipping point back in.
I'm not trying to be a dick and say, like, you know, your stories really suck ass. So
no, it was significant, dude. I mean, there was some decent, like, there was some decent buzz. I think before, with Angel Dust Apocalypse in 2005, it was had sold about 250 copies before the Polonic blurb hit.
Right.
And then the next month, it sold, like, 234 that month. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was definitely significant in getting it to a broader audience. And the other thing was I bought an ad at the Cult. you know?
Oh, yeah.
And that drove, that linked straight through to Amazon, and that drove in so much traffic and so many angry young men and cursing me on forums,
and
you know?
And the Mars Volta thing probably...
The Mars Volta thing is the most read thing I've ever had published in my entire life. Exactly, Over 70,000 people have read that.
Right.
But it wasn't one of those tie-ins where it converts to to interest in literature. Like the Volta fandom does not find itself being, you know, inherently attracted to, at the time, all I had out was short stories, you know, horror short stories. It wasn't something that to them, it was like, they were just, who's this guy? Oh, it's some guy that's doing a write-up for him, you know? And even though it was about weird stuff, and even though it had the same kind of energy, no, I mean, that was a minimum. The first week, I think 70,000 people supposedly read that. And that's, you know, and then it's been out there since then going around.
Was it in the liner notes?
It wasn't in the liner notes. It was just, they did an online release and their publicist was sending it out, and for a while, like, half of it was up on Amazon as just the product information, which was funny because it was really long piece.
Long as hell.
Yeah.
Like 10,000 words, something like that.
Yeah, so that's my most read thing ever, and it also, I got the highest rate of pay per word because Universal Music ended up, I offered to do it for free, and Cedric was like, we'll have Universal pay you, we love how this turned out. And,
hell yeah.
You know?
You gotta, at least you got a check out of it. It's so
Dude, I bought a big screen TV. I bought a Wii. It was actually the beginning of the end of my career. It was super funny because I bought the Wii and I got Resident Evil 4. Yeah. I've talked about this before, obviously. I think on this podcast. So
well, that episode doesn't exist anymore.
Oh, and so. I got Super Mario Galaxy and I got Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess and I got a couple other Wii games. And collectively played them for like 500 or 600 hours when I was supposed to be working on my next book for the same agent I'm trying to produce a book for now. She's been waiting on me for 10 years. She's the most patient woman on earth.
That's fantastic. But it's good to have somebody like that.
She's in my corner. She believes in the work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And so I guess you also did a lot of stuff with spreadsheets too. You're a big spreadsheet guy.
I worked in the business sector in banking for such a long time that I came to see the organizational value of spreadsheets and got okay at using them. So now with every single book, I have my game plan laid out and, you know, I definitely believe in laying out a plan and you can't, an overly ambitious plan. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, maybe you pull off 1/8 of that and it actually helps the book reach people, you know?
Yeah. So what do you think? Because I've tried asking for like more reviews and stuff, and I mean, with Facebook, it didn't. Was getting the reviews just like because people felt that strongly about the book itself, or was it like
with Skullcrack? It was. I mean, with Angel Dust Apocalypse, it was pulling fucking teeth, dude. I mean, it took me 3-4 years to get up to about 63 reviews, and then I remember it just stagnated for like a year at 63.
Lowdown's been stuck at 25 for
Get stuck in these weird spots, and. And so that was super challenging. I had to personally ask people, you know, for every single review initially that's up, you know, on Amazon when you're a writer whose first book is out and nobody's heard of you and nobody has any reason to, you know, was somebody where I politely asked them if they might write a review, you know, please, for the love of God, help me out.
That's almost the point I'm getting to. Well, Black Gum did a lot better. I mean, Black Gum's been out for 2 years now, but it's at 44 or something like that, which is like the most... And then by the time it's been out for 6 years and it's at 40.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like, oh my God. And then, but then you go over to Goodreads and there's 247 reviews of By the Time on
It's
on
way Goodreads. Easier. I feel like the ease of use and people's willingness to just pop off on Goodreads is a lot easier than, you know, like people are perma logged into that if they're logged into their Facebook and stuff versus Amazon. You got to go, you got to log in. You can't use any swear words. There's length restrictions.
Right.
They're culling half the reviews if they find out, you know, people link to the... review page through your Facebook page, stuff like that. There's a lot of inhibiting factors with Amazon versus Goodreads.
It's tougher.
And I think it builds with each book though. I mean, for me, that was the case. Like, you know, when each one comes out, people are more likely to hop on there. And then with Skullcrack, it was something like in the first 2 months, we were up to 50 reviews. Like it
Which
blew
is
my
super
mind.
Important.
Yeah.
That initial
surge was crazy.
Well, that's what happened with Zero Saints too.
Yeah.
Which is probably the one that's done the best on Broken River so far, which was that it just...
It's in the 70s now, yeah?
Yeah, it's in the 70s.
That's
crazy. Yeah, it's the 76, but who's counting?
Yeah.
But no, I mean, it's just, and it sounds so, like, shilly and, you know, just non-artistic, but it's fucking important, dude. Like,
it puts the book in front of people so they know it exists.
And it's
and it puts the books in front of, hopefully, if the algorithms are halfway decent at what they do, in front of the right weird people who will actually enjoy it,
well,
too, you know?
I was like, you know, I was talking about, thinking about audience, and I got this kind of, I always get this rote response from people where it's like, I just write the book I want to read, man. And I'm like, well, of course you do.
Yeah.
Right? That's like a tautology. Like,
why else would you do it?
Why would you write a book that you didn't want to read? Like, that goes without saying. But I think it's like people's way of saying that if the book doesn't catch on or whatever, it's like, it's just what I wanted to read. But that's not why we do it. Like, if we're honest, we want attention.
You want people to read your book, dude.
You want people to read the fucking book and be like, even if they, you know, don't like it or do, like, it's best if they like it, right?
You'd prefer they like it,
too. It's a good feeling. Yeah. Like, all this, like art talk and stuff, there's that, too, but that's in the creation.
Yeah.
But then...
I don't know. I found more and more recently that applying that psychology to the after period, too, is helpful psychologically with how you perceive the world and your willingness to continue making art, for real, you know?
Sure.
Like, and one of the big things for me that I realized was, like, I went through and I looked at a bunch of my favorite books on Goodreads and Amazon, and I spreadsheeted it, right? I did the math and I was like, here's my favorite things that are, you know, I thought would only be, you know, favorites to me because they're so close to my heart, right? And the grand majority of them had about like 85% acceptance rate, and then about 15% of people fucking despised it. I mean, you're talking about, you know, Brand New Cherry Flavor, that Grimson one. I was like, certain like weird things where you're like, I thought I was the only one that even knew about this, or the Mars Volta, or, you know, stuff like that, where it feels very specific, you know? And then I went through and I was like, okay, so no matter what, people are gonna hate shit.
Oh, yeah.
Because art is wildly subjective. And then one day I was sitting on a bus and I was looking around the bus, and I thought to myself, there's nobody here on this bus right now that I inherently feel the desire to tell about my favorite things. It was just this weird, and I probably incorrect, but I was like, I don't think any of these people would enjoy the things I enjoy. Like, you know, some other times you walk into a room and you're like, oh, my nerd family. Like, clearly already love the shit I love. Right. You know, it's almost like an empathic feeling you have with them.
Yeah.
And then I was like, okay, so why would I get fussy if the work I make accidentally makes it in front of one of these people and they think it's shit?
Yeah.
Why would I be fussy about that?
It's true.
The work finds the right readers and the wrong readers, and you just hope for more of the right readers.
Oh, totally.
And then when the wrong readers find it, you go out and you find those people that were the right readers all along but never made the effort of posting a review, and you say, please post a review.
Because
there's somebody standing out in front of my restaurant with a sign that says, don't dine here right now. And
I
know a lot of other people will dig this food, you know?
I have a buddy who recently dropped a book, and the first review of it was 3 stars.
Jesus.
And so he's just
the first one?
The very first one. Which means he's getting out there, right?
Or it means his mom is really mean.
Yeah, exactly. But because it sucks, because then it's like, I'm fucked.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because then even if, you know, your next one is 5, you're still at 4. And, you know, people are like, if you see only 2 reviews and it's an average of 3 or 4, then it's just like, no.
It takes a while to modulate that out.
But no, I mean, that's totally true, man. And I think that, you know, I go back and forth and back and forth, and it's weird. It's just like being a human, I guess. Sometimes I really give a shit and sometimes I really don't.
It's feelings, dude.
Yeah, it's just feelings. Sometimes I have emotions.
Sometimes you get teased on the playground. Sometimes you know, people are like, you're so good at monkey bars.
Yeah, I think it's just I get tired of the writing community as a whole, you know?
The narcissism or the...
Just how boring
navel-gazing,
it is.
Navel-gazing,
it's just boring, you know?
But boring with the pretension of being not boring, as if it's a job that's somehow inherently compelling.
That's right.
You know,
I think that piece of it is a bit. I think I just feel
off-putting.
Bored when I look at it. Because I do. There was something really interesting where, like, Eddie Rathke and Axel Terry, they were telling me about game developers and like following them on Twitter, and they're like actually interesting people. You know what I'm saying? Like, they talk about what they're doing, and maybe it's because it's foreign to me.
Yeah,
you know, that's interesting. But they also say shit post. They're actually funny, and I just wonder, and then I go back to Facebook, and it's like all dad jokes, and all just like, it just feels so like lame.
Well,
you know what I
people
mean?
Are couched in their personas, dude. It's like, and there's that hesitancy to be real person, because sometimes if you show people the real parts of you, you get internet shamed into oblivion.
Right, you know? Yeah.
And so there's that hesitancy in some communities. It's stronger, especially, yeah.
I mean, there have been a few podcasts where I've said things where I'm like, well, I'm pressing the go button on it.
Yeah.
But I'm always like, oh, that was really gross and like homophobic or misogynistic or whatever.
Just could say hot take afterwards.
Yeah, hot take.
Yeah.
But no, I think, I mean, I don't want to shit on it too much. And it's on me to not go to Facebook, right?
Right.
If you know that that's what you're going to get, don't log into the motherfucker.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I guess what I'm saying is that when I go, it just kind of bums me out because Facebook just tends to show me, like, I saw a guy on there who was like super horny recently, and it freaked me out because you could tell he was like, just an older single guy.
Yeah.
And he was like posting memes where he's like, I love to give the pankins. You know what I mean? Like, and this is, it's like other people can see this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's just, it's a lot of that. And then most of the time people who interact with me on there are cool. But then every, you know, it's the thing where you get one asshole and like, that's the thing that you focus on.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where it's just like, you try not to focus on that. Like, I'm starting,
and then ultimately, like 5 minutes later, you're like, I'm deleting this whole thread, even though it's like 97% positive stuff.
Just like,
you get one rando pops in and is like, you're a real piece of shit. You're like, oh, I am. Yeah, I'm the worst.
I have to fuck this whole
thread.
Yeah, no. Yeah. I'll stop a thread if I can feel like, because sometimes I'll do a rant or whatever, and it'll, you know, start getting likes and people are interacting. But then I can feel like the frothy hate start to go sour, but towards wherever I have directed the rage. And then you'll be like, I hope that fucking asshole gets cancer. I'm like, oh, right, I'm gonna put the brakes on this because I'm creating the Ghostbusters river of slime.
Yeah.
And but no, I mean, it's, I feel like all that complaining aside, I'm getting to a better place with it where I'm like, oh, this is a tool.
You just engineer it to whatever you want your psychological experience of the thing to be.
Yeah.
So unfollow, block,
yep,
trickle it back to the 12 friends who you can put up with.
Oh,
you
for
know,
sure. Like, yeah. Well, creating a list where you actually like have those 12 people is really, it's interesting because it's like disciples, right?
Yeah. I find what I have mostly on my feed now is people who talk about horror movies.
Which is fine.
Yeah, which I love.
Yeah, it's cool.
Because it's something separate for me. So it's like, that's the first thing I try to see in my feed every day is people just talking about new horror movies that I will never get to watch because my wife and child won't watch horror movies with me.
I rented The Void.
How was it?
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh.
I rented it. It's on that computer.
I'm tempted. The trailer looked awesome.
Yeah,
the practical effects look great.
I like the whole like 80s revival.
Yeah, I'm not against it, dude.
It's like, it's like people who grew up on, like, whenever you were a kid and you would see that, you'd be like, oh man, if I could make a movie, I would. And then people actually go out and do that, and now the effects can be there.
Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to it. It's a Cthulhu death cult thing, right?
Yeah.
In a hospital?
Yeah, trapped in a hospital.
With like the weird, these people in robes.
It goes dumb though. Like I tried this one called Last Shift a couple weeks ago, and it was like, it did that thing where horror movies, they're really good for about the first 35 minutes,
mm-hmm.
and then they decide they're going to be spooky horror movies or intense horror movies. They're like, dude, this is so brutal. And
he's,
then it's just
his balls crushed.
Right, and it becomes like the most obvious fucking thing, and then you're like, it just, and then you emotionally disconnect all of a sudden.
Yeah, I mean, like, I feel like
horror disappointment is like my deepest disappointment.
I mean, horror movies at a certain point, like they reached kind of like the ape, like with a Serbian film. It's like after that, you could probably stop trying to disturb people because that's been done.
Right.
And then you get something like It Follows, and it, like, that movie is really not scary, but it's cool to watch.
Yeah.
Like, it's a well-made movie. And so, I mean, like, really, like, you're not going to get scared by horror movies anymore. Like, that's not the point, really, I don't think. It's more to, like, most people seem to find it, like, cathartic.
I get scared by relationship dramas. Like, really cutting, like, that old school, like, Neil LaBute, you know, like, In the Company of Men, or Your Friends and Neighbors,
mm-mm.
or Patrick Marber stuff, like, Scenes from a Scandal and Closer, or...
Closer was
brutal. Revolutionary Road. You know, shit like shit that's just scathing indictments of human connection as a whole, or like, Requiem for a Dream, you know,
stuff
just about like pure human horror and our inability to connect and our inherent failings,
mm-hmm.
is the stuff where afterwards I have that echo of just like,
right.
you know, dread. And then also like the descent kind of creeped me out. Like I found I wanted to get out into fresh air as soon as possible.
I feel like
that was a very reptile brain response.
Anything like that movie Buried with Ryan Reynolds.
Yeah.
That was rough, man. That was like really tough for me to kind of cope with because anything claustrophobic.
Yeah.
Where people are like, there's a picture I saw actually on a meme page, and it was just a guy. It was a what do you call him? Cave diver, something like that. Anyway, he was just wedged between two rocks. He wasn't stuck.
Yeah.
He was just, the rocks were pressing him. And I was like,
nope. Yeah. Yeah.
Can't do it. So I don't get people who, those are the people who stayed in the womb like a month over, you know?
Yeah. They're perfectly fine, feeling all cozy. they never had like a brother or a best friend like suffocate them for that 10 seconds too long under a pillow, you know?
Where you start to panic.
Right. Yeah. Like,
Get the fuck off of me.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
It's like super not playing around anymore. You're like, dude, for real. I'm leaving. My mom's coming to pick me up, bro. It was fucked up.
I'm going home. This is fucked up. You're a dick. You're an asshole. Yeah, that's funny. That's all I got, man.
Fair enough, dude.
Do you want to talk about anything else?
No. No? No, I got to get back to work.
Hour 10.
Oh, perfect, dude.
Yeah, right on. Well, hey, thanks for coming by.
Your couch.
Yep.
Anytime, dude.